Thursday, October 22nd. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, with less than 2 weeks to go till the election, President Trump and his Democratic rival, Joe Biden, face off on their final debate tonight. Anger over attacks on protesters in Nigeria spreading to other nations on the continent. Also ahead, a stunning announcement from Pope Francis on same-sex civil union. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump and Democratic challenger Joe Biden are set to square off in their final debate tonight in what is one of the last high-profile events in an increasingly contentious campaign. Biden, who has stepped off the campaign trail to prepare for the debate, expects Trump to get intensely personal. Also on the campaign, former President Barack Obama made his first in-person campaign pitch Wednesday for his former vice president, urging voters at a drive-in car rally in Philadelphia not to sit out the election and risk re-electing President Trump. Joining us now for the latest on the campaign trail is VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. Steve, with less than 2 weeks to go before the election, what is the latest on the campaign trail?
Yes, Lori, on the campaign trail, it's been a real contrast between the incumbent and the challenger. President Trump has been holding this week at least one rally every day in the style we've seen in recent weeks, with big crowds, thousands and thousands of people who are packed close together, a lot of them not wearing masks. While on the Biden campaign trail, the former vice president himself has really not been out. He's preparing for the debate on Thursday night, leaving it up to his running mate, Senator Kamala Harris, to speak to much smaller crowds that are socially distanced and engaging in all sorts of recommended precautions amid the coronavirus pandemic. And then also former President Barack Obama on Wednesday in Philadelphia making his first appearances on behalf of the Biden campaign.
Right. It's Vice President Biden bringing out one of the most popular Democrats out there, and the former president seems a little bit more... He seems very fired up about this election. He doesn't seem to be holding back and quite as reserved as he used to be.
Yes, traditionally, former presidents have pretty much stayed off the campaign trail for their successors or candidates from their own party. And when they have spoken, they've been quite restrained. Obama has broken with that tradition and had a full-throated criticism of the behavior and record of Donald Trump during the past 3.5 years or so. But of course, Donald Trump has not been a traditional president, and that's probably what has motivated Barack Obama, among other things, to engage in such direct criticism of his successor.
And what do we know about this last and final debate between President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden? It's going to be a little bit different. It's the second, not the third, as planned.
Yes, we were supposed to have three. Now it's only two because the president, amid his coronavirus infection, when the debates commission wanted to make that second debate virtual, the president backed out of that. So this will be the second one in person in Nashville, Tennessee. It'll be a little bit different after what we saw with the first debate, where the president quite frequently interrupted and talked over Joe Biden. In this debate, the candidates are being told that they will be able to make their two-minute statement, and presumably if the other candidate talks over their competitor, a mute button will be pressed, or presumably if either candidate rambles on past their allotted time, then that button could also be pressed to silence them. So we'll see whether that button is pressed and how the candidates react to it, because even if the mute button is pressed, the people watching on television may not be able to hear what the candidate is saying, but the people who are in the audience will be able to hear it, including a bunch of reporters.
And it sounds like they'll be debating six different topics, including, of course, the COVID-19 pandemic, race in America, climate change.
One thing that's notable is we're not really going to have a discussion about foreign policy, which a lot of our listeners around the world would very much like to hear about from Donald Trump and Joe Biden.
VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman, thanks as always. U.S. Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe said Wednesday that Russia and Iran have both tried to interfere with the 2020 presidential election. Ratcliffe made the announcements at a hastily arranged news conference that also included FBI Director Chris Wray. The announcement 2 weeks before the election showed the level of alarm among top U.S. officials that foreign actors are seeking to undermine Americans' confidence in the integrity of the vote and spread misinformation in an attempt to sway the outcome. In Germany, policymakers are awaiting the outcome of the U.S. presidential election in the belief that it will have significant consequences for their country and for Europe. Jacob Russell has this report from Berlin.
In Germany, many feel the stakes in the U.S. presidential election are higher here than in any other country in Europe. The EU's largest economy hosts around 36,000 U.S. troops, and at $200 billion a year, this is America's single largest trade partner in Europe. But the historically close relationship between the two countries has chilled since Mr. Trump started accusing Germany of not paying its fair share on NATO defense. Some German policymakers are now concerned about the future of the transatlantic alliance.
This road has been bumpy over the last 4 years with the United States. That is less about Europe, more about other things in the world, or less about protecting and being the guardian of the international order. This country, built on that order, is trying to understand and reposition accordingly to those changes.
Trump's decision this year to reduce the number of U.S. troops stationed in Germany has sown even greater doubts about America's overall commitment to the NATO alliance.
If America leaves and NATO is no more, I would see European frictions rising rather than the opposite, that Europe will come together. So we will have a very fractious confrontation-heavy European continent.
The pessimism is not universal. The far-right party, Alternative for Germany, has welcomed the Trump administration's move to reduce the U.S. military presence in the country. Others see new opportunities, regardless of who the next American president is.
It is not a result of the Trump presidency that the United States has set other priorities for themselves, which lie in the Asia-Pacific, for example. And I think it is high time that the Europeans grow up and sort of emancipate themselves from that dependency on the United States.
Whatever the outcome across the Atlantic, many here in Berlin believe that for better or for worse, change could be on the horizon. Jacob Russell for VOA News, Berlin.
Nigerians in Ghana are joining growing diaspora protests against police brutality in the West African nation, spurred on by events Tuesday night in Lagos, where soldiers allegedly opened fire on unarmed protesters. Stacey Knott reports from Accra.
Across the world, people are expressing outrage over the events in Lagos late Tuesday. On Tuesday, after Lagos state authorities announced a 24-hour curfew, eyewitnesses said soldiers opened fire on demonstrators at Lekki Toll Plaza, with casualties reported. Nigeria's army denied it was responsible for deaths at the scene, branding stories that blame soldiers for the casualties as fake news. Meanwhile, what started out as a movement to end a notorious police unit has now evolved into demands for widespread reform in Nigeria. In Accra on Wednesday, about 150 people gathered outside the Nigerian High Commission. Most were from Nigeria, but they were supported by a handful of Ghanaian compatriots. Franklin Digbe, a Ghanaian DJ, said he was there because the two nations were intertwined in many aspects, especially with entertainment. He said what was happening in Nigeria was atrocious and called for solidarity.
It's very necessary because we're here when we saw the George Floyd thing happen, and it was like, yeah, okay, Black Lives Matter, and this was something that we saw and we had solidarity across the world for. So if you're in Ghana and you're seeing this happening in Nigeria, then we should all come together as people.
Also at the protest was Nigerian citizen Endohemba Oria. He said he hoped protests would lead to real change in his country.
If I was in Lagos yesterday, I would be at the protest ground because I'm passionate about my country. I hate it when people talk bad about Nigeria. If the Nigerian government is good, 50% of Nigerians living in every part of the world will go back home and settle back home and do legitimate business.
There have been protests and candlelit vigils across the world in the past week, including in Canada, the United Kingdom, the US, Egypt, Australia and South Africa. Damiola Odufua in Lagos said it was more important than ever to see global solidarity as Nigeria's largest city is now under curfew. The activist is one of the founding members of the Feminist Coalition, a Nigerian organisation working to get legal help, funding and supplies to protesters across Nigeria. She wanted global bodies to also speak out for Nigerian protesters and believed international pressure would help Nigerians exercise their constitutional rights.
We are united in this fight against police brutality and against bad governors. All we want is good leadership. And that has been really touching to see people come out and stand up for us. And we pray that tomorrow, while we are under some form of curfew where our internet is kind of slowing down, that people speak up for us.
As the protest has evolved, the hashtag #EndBadGovernance has also trended on social media. The protest is backed by global celebrities, such as Twitter founder Jack Dorsey, singing star Beyonce, and Nigerian entertainers Davido and Wizkid. US presidential candidate Joe Biden and former US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton criticized the state response to the demonstrations on Tuesday, with Clinton tweeting that Nigeria's president and army should stop killing young NSARS protesters. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
In Thailand, tens of thousands of protesters marched toward the Prime Minister's office on Wednesday demanding his resignation. Prime Minister Prayuth Chan-o-cha, who took power in a 2014 coup, denies accusations that he rigged an election last year, pleaded with protesters to resolve political differences through parliament. The protests began in July but have swelled over the past 8 days. Demonstrators are demanding constitutional changes, more freedom for students, and reforms to the country's powerful monarchy. Philip Sherwell is the Asia correspondent for the Sunday Times and has been covering the demonstrations in Bangkok. VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to him for more details on the situation.
Yeah, they feel that they started off with relatively moderate political requests earlier this year when these protests first started. They were triggered by the banning of a popular progressive opposition party that did very well with young voters last year in the elections. They were demanding political reforms. Then those reforms, those demands have morphed into calls for the Prime Minister to step down. And a couple of months ago, they did then take this very dramatic turn of calls for royal reforms. These are primarily students. They're primarily young people. They really do feel that this society needs to change. It's a very hierarchical, top-down society. And exactly what they are protesting against, which is orders being sort of set down from the military and requirements to behave certain ways in school and the whole sort of royal tradition and etiquette, that's what they're sort of fighting against. So when this same government was saying no concessions, you know, they were hinting that in a couple of years maybe they could consider changing the constitution, but really no concessions, no compromise, and now you have to stop and go home, that just further incited people and further angered people. And there is just this mood now of, if not now, then when? There is a hashtag of, you know, end this in our generation. And young people here just sort of say, when we talk to them on the streets, we've had enough.
And can you describe, what's it been like at the protests? You know, what does it feel like? What does it look like?
Yes, it's actually interesting. I reported a lot from Hong Kong last year, and there was a distinct feeling of those sort of Hong Kong leaderless protests, you know, where sort of people are on social media apps, they're sort of talking to each other as they gather. There's the flashing of the lights from the phones at night. The defiance and anger is also mixed with quite a bit of good humor. There's a lot of coded language playing on Thai puns and language to sort of refer to the police and the government. They're very intent on holding their ground. And when I say holding their ground, I mean they're sort of, their ground is very much, they move the demonstrations each day. They only announce them very late on. They don't want to sort of make the mistake of trying to carve out a particular protest site, and then it will be easy, as they see it, for the police and the security forces to move in the trucks and the riot squads. There are also protests now taking place across the country in smaller numbers, but outside Bangkok. So it does feel at the moment as though there is the country is really facing a very considerable, very deep standoff and very deep rift, because these people aren't going home, but there are very substantial bodies of support for the establishment. There's still deep respect and veneration for the royal family amongst large swathes of the population. So it's quite a split society at the moment.
Philip Sherwell, Asia correspondent for the Sunday Times in Bangkok, speaking with VOA's Jason Patinkin.
Greece's Navy has issued a code orange alert advising battleships to surround a cluster of tiny islands in the southeast Aegean Sea and prepare for potential hostile action from Turkey. Antti Karasava reports on the dangerous standoff that's further complicating efforts by the United States and the European Union to get the two sides to negotiate a maritime settlement.
Greece's defense ministry on Wednesday released pictures of what Greek officials called a protective wall, illustrating what it called the severity of the looming standoff with Turkey. Military officials tell VOA Greek gunboats circled Kaselorizo and a number of uninhabited islands in a move they said is meant to shield Greek territory against Turkish attempts to survey disputed waters for oil and gas. Ankara redeployed the Oroutre survey ship earlier this month, just weeks after it had recalled it from a similar mission that nearly brought Greece and Turkey to the brink of war over energy rights in the eastern Mediterranean. U.S. and EU officials have since then been trying to get both sides to sit down and negotiate their differences. But analysts say what makes this redeployment dangerous is that the Turkish vessel has come so close to the Greek coast. The Code Orange alert was issued as the Oroutre sailed just 14 kilometers off the shores of Kaselorizo, the nearest any Turkish vessel has come to a Greek island during the standoff. The survey ship has since then been entering the contested zone, guarded by a formation of Turkish battleships and submarines. More than 60 Greek ships are in the region monitoring the vessel's moves. Ankara insists it is within its rights to survey the region for gas and oil. But Greek government officials like State Minister Yorgos Hierapetritis warn that any breach of Greek sovereignty will be met with force. He says Greece will never allow any illegal drilling to take place, and it will never relinquish its sovereign rights to exploit the seabed as far as 19 kilometers from the coast of Greek islands. NATO allies Greece and Turkey have long been at odds over conflicting oil and sea rights. Athens is now trying to convince the EU member states to stop selling arms to Turkey. It also wants to impose sanctions on Turkey, a bid that Germany and others are strongly resisting. Alexis Papagelas, managing editor and a commentator on defense and foreign policy at the Kathimerini newspaper in Athens, warns that the Greek Navy buildup marks an escalation of tensions that could be playing into Turkey's hands.
He
says this is an ongoing war of nerves, and that the biggest fear is for the Greek side to fall in the trap of escalating tension, he says. That's exactly what Ankara wants right now in order to pin the blame on Greece. The Oroutre is expected to complete its survey later this week. But observers say it may get orders to stay longer to explore for oil and gas, something that could prolong the tensions. Antti Karasava for VOA News, Athens.
A United Nations mediator reports positive developments after 2 days of face-to-face peace talks involving military leaders from Libya's warring parties. A fourth round of the Libyan Joint Military Commission aimed at achieving a permanent ceasefire is taking place in Geneva this week. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The head of the UN support mission in Libya, Stephanie Williams, says the two sides have reached agreements on several important issues which directly impact the lives and welfare of the Libyan people. Williams says the Libyan delegations have agreed to open land routes that connect all the regions and cities of Libya and to resume flights throughout the country. She says they have agreed to stop the use of inflammatory language and to hold accountable those who use hate speech on social media to incite violence. She says Libya's military leaders also have agreed to support the current calm in the country and to avoid any military escalation. Williams says she believes these agreements will stick because they are Libyan-owned solutions.
And I think that is really the most optimistic and positive development that I have seen. After all, it's their country, and Libya is for Libyans. And that is why I continue to be very optimistic that the parties here are going to reach a more lasting and permanent ceasefire.
Libya has been in a state of turmoil since former dictator Muammar Gaddafi was killed in 2011. A violent nationwide power struggle has been ongoing between two rival governments, the internationally recognized government in the capital Tripoli and the Benghazi-based Libya National Army headed by renegade commander Khalifa Haftar. Fighting has died down in recent months under international pressure. While expressing optimism about the talks, Williams says she sees many difficulties ahead as the parties dig into thornier issues of the agreement.
We are in a sense in a bit of a race against time here. Because of the conditions in the country and, frankly, because of the degree of flagrant foreign intervention and blatant violations of the arms embargo.
Turkey is a main supporter of the UN-recognized government in Tripoli. Russia and the United Arab Emirates are among other countries allied with Haftar's forces. All have come under criticism for violating the UN arms embargo and fueling Libya's destructive, chaotic civil war. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Greece's Navy has issued a code. Pope Francis has become the first pontiff to endorse same-sex civil unions. The papal approval appeared in the feature-length documentary Francesco, which premiered on Wednesday at the Rome Film Festival. The declaration sparked cheers from gay Catholics and demands for clarification from conservatives, given the Vatican's official teaching on the issue. The film, which features fresh interviews from the Pope, delves into issues Francis cares about most, including the environment, poverty, migration, racial and income inequality, and discrimination. You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
They're still trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House.
VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series. Education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.
VOA's International Edition continues. The World Health Organization says about 50 million people worldwide suffer from Alzheimer's disease or some form of dementia. And during the COVID-19 pandemic, providing proper hands-on care for dementia patients has become markedly more difficult and stressful for the patients and their loved ones. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Jason Karlowish, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine and co-director of the Penn Memory Center, to hear more.
The data from millions of persons who have been infected with COVID show that it's not just a respiratory infection, but the generalized effects it can have can cause people to develop confusion and lingering cognitive problems. And certainly in individuals who have a brain disease already, COVID makes that worse.
What are the reasons for that?
The reasons for that are several. For individuals with dementia living in the community, because of the need for social isolation and distancing, many of the supports that kept them going aren't available anymore. So, for example, in America, we have adult day activity programs that are tailored to their needs and disabilities. Well, all those programs shut down because of social distancing and the risk of spreading infection. In addition, home health aides who would come to help out with care at home, many of them had to stay away as well. And family members restrained because many of them said, well, now I have to figure out what to do all day here with my relative who can't leave the house. I can't leave the house, and had to deal with a relative who had a hard time understanding why they couldn't go out, why do I need to wear a mask, etc. So what we began to see in the community was increased reports from their family members of strain and stress, and their relative having increased problems with agitation and not getting the kind of care that they used to get. So that was the trials and tribulations that we're witnessing in people in the community.
And what about the many dementia patients living in long-term care facilities?
In long-term care settings, it's even worse. They, too, went into what was called lockdown in an effort to limit the spread of COVID in the institution. And that all made sense because, of course, we don't know in the beginning how infectious this was. We didn't have enough personal protective equipment anyway. But, of course, that has now caused harms because they lack the visits from family members that they used to have because visitors were prohibited. These visitors, of course, are not just visitors coming to make a social call. These family members are essential caregivers, just as essential as the paid staff. And they would do things like help the person get up, engage them in conversation activities that were meaningful. And when you took all that care away, what we found were residents losing weight, falling, getting agitated, and quite frankly, dying. And that's why we're seeing the increased deaths in individuals with Alzheimer's disease over and above from COVID caused by social isolation and distancing that had to be done. Because if we didn't do that, we would have spread the infection even farther and wider. A lot of tough choices, a lot of tough trade-offs.
So it's not just dementia sufferers themselves, but everyone around them, too.
You know, there's no question. Alzheimer's ramifies across people. Oftentimes, they're a spouse or partner, adult child or friend. And for much of the disease course, they provide kind of a cognitive prosthetic for the person. They make decisions, do tasks like manage finances, make a meal, plan a trip, etc. You're sort of like an extended mind, if you will, of the other person. And that's a fairly highly intense role.
In plain words, how do you think the future looks for dementia patients and their caregivers going forward?
I'm cautiously optimistic and cautiously hopeful that out of this great, vast, common story of suffering that we're experiencing, we might find kind of a theme that says caregiving and caregivers are so important, and we've really ignored them. And maybe now we recognize how important they are and how much we need them.
And Paul McCartney plans to release a solo album in December. McCartney 3 will be a new collection of stripped-back songs, all written, performed, and produced by the ex-Beatle, 50 years after his first solo album. It joins two other albums, McCartney and McCartney 2, created single-handedly by the 78-year-old at critical times in his life. This one is described as offering a vast and intimate range of modes and moods, from soul-searching to wistful, from playful to raucous, and all points in between. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today. But you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vungani, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for being with us, and have a great day. Don't be afraid.